Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and we're here this morning with the Chancellor of the Sheehy Schools, the State System of Higher Education Schools, Chancellor McCormick. And this morning we'd like to talk about the State System of Higher Education, but first I'd like to ask you if you wouldn't mind giving our audience a little bit of background on you.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk with you this morning. I'm a native Pennsylvanian. I graduated from Indiana University of Pennsylvania, the state system. Have a master's and doctoral degree from the University of Pittsburgh, but I have served now over 40 years of public service in the schools of Pennsylvania as a school teacher, as a secondary administrator at Shippensburg, as a professor and dean and vice president at Bloomsburg University from 1973 to 1983 as the president of that fine institution. And then I had the privilege of being the first chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, coming here on July 1 of 1983. And I've had a chance to serve the 14 universities and our 95,000 students in this capacity for this period of time.
Would you do me a favor and explain to our audience this, now it's called SHEHE, State System of Higher Education. What is it, and would you explain the schools that are in the state system? Because sometimes people misunderstand how is the University of Pennsylvania State School, how is Temple Estate School. Would you give us a little bit of background on that, please?
Pennsylvania citizens are very fortunate in having a wide range of diverse institutions to consider. There are basically four sectors. We have the community colleges, and there are 14 or 15 of them that serve various regions of the Commonwealth. Then we have the state-related universities, Pitt, Penn State, Temple, and Lincoln. And then we have a group of very fine private independent colleges and universities as well. And then, of course, the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. This system is made up primarily of the 14 universities. They include, from west to east, Edinburgh University, Slippery Rock University, California University, and Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I might add that Indiana University has two branch campuses under its auspices, one in Oil City and one in Katanning and one in Punxsutawney, and then Clarion, the fifth one in the West, has a branch in Oil City. So Clarion University is part of it. Coming on across the northern tier, Lock Haven University, they have a branch campus in Clearfield. Mansfield University in the northern tier, East Stroudsburg University in the Poconos, Bloomsburg University on Route 80, then getting to the east and going south to Westchester University in Westchester, Cheney University, and then coming back to the mid part of the state, Kutztown University in the Reading-Allentown area, Millersville University in the Lancaster area, and Shippensburg University in the Cumberland Valley. And I think, Ken, that makes up the 14. Did I miss any? Yes, so I think that's the 14. Now, in addition to that, in addition to these 14 campuses and the branch campuses, we have the Education Resources Center, which is operated here out of Harrisburg, and that serves the university statewide with certain non-traditional programs. Plus, we have the center here at Harrisburg at the Dixon Center, where approximately 1,700 students are attending. By the way, that's an interesting collaborative, because seven of our universities teach classes here, but so does Duquesne, the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, and Elizabethtown College. So we have a collaborative here of private and publics working together. Now, this Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education is the largest higher education enterprise in the state when you consider it all together. We're serving more than 95,000 students. About 90% of them are Pennsylvanians. About 80% of that group stays in the state. We have a mission of providing high-quality, affordable education to the citizens of the Commonwealth. We have about 500,000 alumni, more than 350,000 of them living in the state at this time, and we are a provider of the development of human resources for the Commonwealth. We started, and this may be of some interest to your listeners, our history. Most of the institutions are over 100 years old. They started as local academies and normal schools and became in the 20s and 30s state teachers' colleges, and in the 60s they became state colleges, with Indiana University at that time gaining university status. And while our primary mission for many of those years was teacher education, it now is still a matter of primary concern. But only about 20% of our students, 25 at the most, some institutions lower than 20, are now in teacher education. And we've developed programs in the liberal arts, business, the healthcare area, and we're a very comprehensive state university system with these regional institutions. I think that's might give our listeners a sense of this organization. I should acknowledge the fact that half of our income, that is the money to provide for the operating expenses, comes from the taxpayers, the citizens of Pennsylvania. We are state-owned, and the other half of the funds we have approximately $1 billion budget. The other half comes from independent fundraising, from tuition, fees that we charge for room and board, but we are owned by the Commonwealth, and believe that we have a major mission of high-quality, affordable education.
How are you different then? What sets you apart from the rest of the colleges and universities in the state? Why would someone choose to come to a state system school versus one of the other private schools?
Well, as I said earlier, Pennsylvania citizens have a great choice, and we are blessed in this state with many fine colleges and universities in all of the sectors. Now, when students ask me the question you did, I encourage them to look at all of the alternatives, to consider what it is they want to major in, and the kind of a campus they want to attend, location, and to visit not only ours but others as well. Now, some of the qualities that our students find at our institutions. First, we have what many consider to be an outstanding faculty. We've placed a great deal of emphasis on the quality of our faculty. We compensate them at a standard that makes us attractive. We're able to attract some of the best and brightest people from around the country to these faculty positions, and we're able to retain them. A very high-quality faculty. They're committed to teaching. That doesn't mean teacher education, although some of them do that, but we're committed to the teaching of undergraduate students. We try to have reasonably sized classes, and these faculty members are of very high quality who want to teach. We also, with their PhDs, are doing some research and public service too, although that's less a mission for us than some of the others. We do have master's degree programs in fields that serve the region, and of course our doctoral programs at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. So, quality faculty. We have been, thanks to the Commonwealth and to generous givers, we're having more and more people. We've raised over $30 million private money last year. We have a fine physical plant. We have approximately 800 buildings, 70% of them built in the last 30, 35 years. We have a number of buildings that are being renovated and new construction, so fine facilities. We have a diversified student body. We have lots of applications generally in the system, although the campuses differ in terms of those numbers. And then I think we have the programs. We've been very responsive to the needs of the Commonwealth, and so we have the programs in teacher education, but we've developed the new ones, computer technology, For instance, at Westchester, just as one example, and I could cite each of them, we are developing major new programs to support the pharmaceutical industry. We've had a long history of men and women graduating from this system that have served Pennsylvania's needs in the broad area, not only education, but the health fields, the business fields. And we also, at our campuses, in every one of them, have a strong liberal arts and science program, so that which includes all of the disciplines, art, music, and that sort of thing. So I guess, in summary, fine professors, good facilities, and programs that are in tune and aligned with what Pennsylvania needs.
With the alterations and changes happening and occurring in education today, there's a great emphasis now, because of our technology and computers, on distance learning. How is the state system responding to those needs of students who not only would like to be educated in the computer sciences and technology, but would like to take courses? And what impact does that have on the state system schools as far as the structures go and the future of the Sheehy schools?
Well, I personally believe that we're in a time of great change in higher education, and that providers of higher education include not only those I mentioned from the various sectors in Pennsylvania, but the providers also include the private sector, the entrepreneurial colleges and universities, like the Apollo Company that provides graduate courses through what they call the Phoenix University. And I think that it'll be more competitive, more and more providers, if I could use that term, will be providing programs to students at their convenient time in their locations. So I personally see that there will be great, great growth opportunities in the area of distance learning, and programs that deliver these opportunities to students at convenient times in their lives. A lot of that, I think, will be non-traditional education, continuing education, that sort of thing. I still think there will be many, many parents in Pennsylvania that will want their daughters and sons to experience a more traditional 4-year, 5-year education at a residential campus. I still think that market will be there. But increasingly, those that need to come back for retraining, or those that have families, have jobs, or some distance, will get their needs met by providers that do it in new and creative ways. And we want the state system universities to pay attention to that market as well. And so we do have here at the system level a individual who's our chief technology officer. We are advancing the technology agenda. For instance, we've tied all of our libraries together in the new Keystone Library System, so that not only do all of our campuses have access to what every other campus has, but we've tied it in with the state library, and we provided it at all of our regional campuses. And we have a number of initiatives going on in collaborative agreements. We've developed a new course at between Slippery Rock and Clarion that provides opportunities for nurses using distance learning. We're providing opportunities at South Point from California to meet students' needs. We've had a virtual university project where Westchester, Millersville, and Shippensburg have started to experiment with that. So we want to move along. We have more courses this year than last, and it will be an important agenda for us to serve that market. But we do also want to pay attention to our traditional markets, the undergraduates, the 18 to 22-year-olds, and we think there will be a lot of those that will want to come to campuses with residence halls and various programs.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Chancellor McCormick of the State System of Higher Education, and we're talking about higher education and its future in the state of Pennsylvania. Now, I recently attended the hearings, and I'm sure it was some of our listeners saw it on PCN. And I, frankly, was very appalled to see the manner with which the legislators had their philosophical premise about the state system schools. I personally believe there is a very, very specific function that the state schools provide for students, but there was much emphasis on numbers. And when I began to understand how the numbers come to be, it really doesn't equate with and give people a really good perception of the students who perhaps are going to the state system schools for the first 2 years and then transferring to state schools, larger schools like the University of Pennsylvania or University of Pittsburgh. So how can we indicate performance of the state schools and really do a good job of determining the kinds of work that they're doing, which I frankly believe is excellent, and still have assessments that are equatable to what's really going on?
Well, I appreciate you raising that question, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about it. In defense of the General Assembly the executive branch, this is a time across the country of increased accountability. Huge sums of public money are going into education, both basic and public and private, too. We invest public funds in private support of private students that go to private schools as well. And I think across the country, legislators and citizens and taxpayers are asking the hard questions about what it is they get with the investment. And so we welcome the opportunity to have those discussions, and we're trying to be very accountable. That is, the board has developed 24 outcome assessments that we're measuring and prepared to talk about. We have done some systemic change here to make us more accountable. You know, costs for students and parents as well as taxpayers is a very important issue, and we're trying to be as efficient as we can. So I, as a public policy person and a person who really does serve the public of this state, I think the accountability issues are fair game and need to be discussed, and I think those of us that spend public monies need to answer tough questions. And you know, the legislators are faced with many Pennsylvania needs, older citizens, the basic education, the corrections, and all of that, and pressures to cut taxes. So I think it's an environment that will continue to be difficult and hard, and perhaps appropriately so. Now, having said that, we have outstanding students that attend these universities, and we as part of telling our story better, we've commissioned a study. We have some preliminary results that really talk to employers about the success of our graduates, and it's very positive, and we will look forward to you in a few weeks sharing that research report. We also have asked our students how they feel about the programs and how well prepared they are. We have those results back and have included those in our continuous improvement, and they're quite positive. And we've asked our alumni their views. And while I'm mentioning the alumni, one of the great measures of institutions like ours are the success of the graduates. And this discussion at the legislative hearing has generated a lot of interest, and we have wonderfully talented graduates in all fields, the business world, in the legislature, in the executive branch, in the healthcare fields, in teaching, and we've been really talking about that. And it was wonderful for me as the chief executive officer of this system to see such an outpouring of the graduates who were concerned about the fact that people didn't quite understand their capabilities. And so we've just we have wonderful people. There's and sometimes it's very interesting to me that teacher education graduates, there's this concern about too many teachers, and we're paying attention to that too. But a number of our education graduates have gone on to do wonderful things. There is an executive with a major biotech company that was an elementary teacher and has gone to the leadership in that company. And we just have these graduates all over that are serving Pennsylvania, the nation, and the world. And I think there's a lesson in this for us, too, at the system level and at the universities. We need to energize our alumni and our students, and we need to tell our story better about the great contributions of the graduates of this system. One of the things that keeps me motivated and passionate about my job is that I really do believe that the most precious resource in Pennsylvania is the human resource. It's the people of Pennsylvania. And these universities, for over 100 years, have been giving the sons and daughters of Pennsylvanians an opportunity to get a fine education and make a great contribution. And if Pennsylvania is going to be the Keystone State, both competitively in terms of the economic activity, but also in the quality of life, it will be because we've developed the people of Pennsylvania, and this university system is very committed to that. And I might add that we're paying attention, too, to the changing demographics of this state. And we have quite a new group of individuals that are coming. We are very committed to serving the African American community of the state, and we have this new growing Latino community, particularly in the eastern part of the state, that we're paying attention to. And we're very committed, the board and the system, to diversity and serving all Pennsylvanians. You know, there was a period of time on this very touchy subject of affirmative action and so on when we did some of this, probably because it was the law, and others had a moral commitment about it. But now I think it's all about, if Pennsylvania is going to make it and remain competitive, we need to bring everybody to a point to be all that they can be, so that they can take their place in the Pennsylvania workforce, whether it be in the quality of life side or the economic side, and be able to serve. So this is a time when we need, at the state level and from the taxpayer point of view, to look upon education and the state system as not another government expense, but an investment in our most precious resource, the people of Pennsylvania.
I'm not sure that I'm in agreement with you as far as the that there are too many teachers, because I've been around the state and I know that there are many places where they are both at the level of the elementary and high school level and at the university level, where they are looking for people all over, and have, as a matter of fact, as well as the administrative level, there are some places that don't have administrators. So I'm not quite sure that I agree with the governor in the fact that, you know, there is a glut of teachers in this. I think perhaps in some places there are, but I don't think that it's continuous throughout. And as a matter of fact, throughout the United States, we receive phone calls from states all over where they are in need of teachers.
Thank you for giving me a chance to clarify that. When I said that we're looking through our planning process and an alignment of making sure that the graduates we turn out are align better with what Pennsylvania needs, that is true. But you're absolutely right. In the teacher education area, there are shortages in certain fields. The sciences, mathematics, we have need for certified teachers in urban centers that are not available, and there are shortages in certain areas, and there's some oversupply in some of the other areas as well. And your national point is a good one. Some states, California and Maryland and others, are facing one of the most serious teacher shortages in their history, and they're actively recruiting Pennsylvania teachers, and our placement rate for our teachers is really very, very good, in the high 80% of those that get teaching jobs, but some of them do go out of state. And so you're absolutely right about that. And it's an interesting problem. When you look at it from one side and you turn out too many teachers, you can raise a question. But from the side of the parent who's paid taxes all of these years, and the students, if they want to be a history teacher, and there are too many of those, how do you deny them the opportunity to be what they want to be, and even if it means that you might lose them? One of the concerns that I felt at the budget hearings, all through the budget hearings, is a concern on the part of Pennsylvania leadership, both governmental and business, that we can't afford to lose the talented people. So while we're happy when our graduates do very well, and we have to celebrate their success, even if it isn't in Pennsylvania. On the other hand, we need to do everything we can to hold this talent here because we need it. But you're absolutely right. The teacher education number issue is far more complex than some think. And some students, you know, want to go back to their home district and get a job there. They don't even want to move too far away from home. And of course, the jobs don't always develop right in the home area.
Well, I think, you know, you bring up a really something that I've seen across the state, and that is that I don't think Pennsylvania itself, and it's not just in the teacher market, but in the job market as well, does not keep does not have enough opportunities for its students to stay here, and which is why they go elsewhere. It has nothing to do with the state system or any of the other institutions. It has to do with the economics of the state and the fact that there are many more better opportunities elsewhere. And I personally am a graduate of Pennsylvania school, so and I found that, you know, my opportunities were elsewhere rather than here. Also, I held a conference here in several years ago, bringing our schools, the schools that we have from around the country here, to let Pennsylvania educators know the kinds of innovations that were happening around the country. And I had requests from my schools from Florida to come just to try and lure some of the students here to come down and teach in the state of Florida. So I'm very cognizant of these things. And as far as the changing demographics go, can we talk a little bit about the kinds of students who are now coming to school? It is very different than it was even 5 years ago. Can you give us a little bit of information? Because people look at numbers, but they really don't know what's behind those numbers. Let's talk a little bit about the demographics of the kinds of students attending schools today.
Well, perhaps we just need to go back earlier in this century, when a very small percentage of the population, perhaps less than 10%, I think considerably less than that, actually attended four-year colleges or universities. And of course, the big boost in attendance came following World War II, when the GI Bill, one of the greatest programs, I think all would agree, almost everybody would agree in the country, provided opportunities for the men, mostly men, but probably some women who came back from World War II to get an educational opportunity. We had a great growth during that period, and that coincided with the complexity of our society, the industrialization and the change. And then as the baby boomers began to want to have opportunities for their children, we had the great growth in the 60s and the 70s. In fact, our university system probably tripled during this period that I'm describing. You know, at the turn of the middle of the century, we were closer to 20 or 30,000 students in the system, and not 90, 95. So the great growth. Now what's happened is, as the society's become more complex and higher skills are needed, more and more of the students have needed to participate in post-secondary education. So now we do have a much larger percentage, 60-70% of the students who graduate from high school participating in post-secondary education. Now, and we also have older students coming back who didn't have an opportunity at an earlier time, often women with children who, if they're going to have career opportunities, need to enhance their educational opportunities. So the mix of the students are changing quite a bit. And while we want to have graduation rates that are as good as they can be, and we don't want to have things that we do, like scheduling problems, stand in the way, we do have many students now who work. In fact, 54% of our students have jobs. And some of them are older students. They have children. They want to work 20, 30 hours a week and take six courses, that is six credits. And so their time frame is to graduate in 5 and 6 years. The other thing is that an earlier day, you kind of started with your group and graduated with your group. Now, higher education has become much more agile and flexible. And it's possible for students to take a course, drop out, come back, and be able to meet their needs on their time frame. Also, students are not always sure when they graduate from high school what they want to major in. And they sometimes explore, they think they like both art and political science, and they take a little test of both and decide they want to be an art major. And sometimes that costs a few courses to figure out what it is that they want to do. We also, and I'm not being critical of the sending schools, because I think it's our responsibility in the state university system to work with the schools and to be a seamless weld of working together. But there are students that come that have certain deficiencies in their preparation, and yet they have the ability to succeed, and maybe they have writing skill problems. So it's not uncommon for us to have those students take a couple of courses in special composition and writing to help them get up to standards, which means it takes a little longer. So it's a very complicated subject, but I can assure you the state system is going to be working in every way to help students and parents move through the system as efficiently as possible.
The reason I brought this subject up was because legislators were taking offense, I noticed at the hearings, to students that were taking longer to graduate and saw this as somehow a deficiency in the state system without understanding that the changing demographics of the people who are going, which is why I brought up, wanted you to educate the public who were probably watching PCN, to the reason why this is happening. It has nothing to do with what's happening at the state system. It has to do with the demographics of society. You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Chancellor McCormick from the State System of Higher Education. And you can reach him or any one of his staff at 717-720-4054. That's 717-720-4054. Or you can visit them on the website. You can also reach them at their website at sshechan.edu. That's www.sshechan.edu. Or you can reach us anytime toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Or you can email us at ProKids, ProKids, at RLC.net. That's ProKids at RLC.net. Please join us for our second half hour. We're going to let our stations identify themselves, and we'll be right back. Second half hour, we are here with Chancellor McCormick from the State System of Higher Education. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski and Children Come First. And we're talking about the status of the State System of Higher Education and some of the things that are going on in the state schools. There are several questions that I had personally. First of all, much of the state of Pennsylvania is rural. How do you assist the students who are in places who cannot come to the Sheehy schools? Do you have anything to help those students to come?
I believe the statistics will say that this is the, if not the lead, one of the very large rural populations in the nation. And it's really good that we're located in not only the 14 locations, but we have, as I mentioned earlier, the Katanning campus, the Punxsutawney campus — Katanning's called the Armstrong campus — the Oil City campus, the Clearfield campus, South Point, the Preco Center in Erie. So not only are we at the 14 locations, but we have others as well. So we're placed quite well across the state. And sometimes, you know, there are questions at the legislative hearing about the enrollment numbers and so on in our rural campuses, but I always point out that it's essential to keep these institutions strong and viable in these areas, because there are students in that 40-50 mile radius that probably would not have an opportunity to go to college without our institutions. We also, it's clear, provide a very significant economic impact. And, of course, the cultural center for many of these regions — the art, the music, the athletics, the other kinds of activities — center around these campuses. And so I think Pennsylvania is fortunate that these public universities are spread out across all of Pennsylvania. Now, what do we do to bring to our citizens the knowledge about the system? We spend quite a bit of our resources in actually having individuals from the campus visit the high schools. We still think that while literature and the internet and all of these other things need to be used, there's no substitute for someone from the university visiting these high schools. And it's not uncommon for us to have several of our universities visit these rural high schools, the very small ones even, and to have an opportunity to talk with guidance counselors and teachers, and particularly students and parents. So we're still doing that. We're tending to have some regional activities where we're bringing students together in some joint recruitment, particularly some of our minority students. We're working on that in some of the areas where we don't have campuses close by, and having an opportunity to invite parents and students. In addition to that, we're working much more aggressively than we did earlier to have a seamless transfer between the community colleges and the what we call the baccalaureate institutions, our four-year colleges and universities. And we are making some progress by making that move possible. In fact, we encourage, as I'm sure your public knows, the community colleges are primarily the first 2 years. And our baccalaureate institutions, which also have master's degrees, are the third and fourth year, or the upper level, the last half of the baccalaureate education. And we think that it makes excellent sense for us to work closely with the community colleges and them with us, so that those students will have the opportunity to attend our two institutions and get what they need. And we're trying to do more with publications, and for instance, we have a booth at the farm show. We find that is a great opportunity to have parents and students from the rural areas realize that we exist and that we have opportunities. That booth is very popular, and it's still a high priority for many of the students from the rural areas to come with their parents, either on a school day, when I think the schools support it, or a weekend, and come to the farm show. So we're trying to reach out, trying to have students know about the opportunities in the state system, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to your listening audience about opportunities at our institutions.
What is the difference between, you kind of mentioned it in a little bit earlier, what's the difference between a university and a college? I don't think some of our, when did the Sheehy schools become universities?
Well, our 14 institutions have been developing very rapidly over the last 40 or 50 years. IUP developed a little more rapidly than the others and gained university status. Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and they gained university status about 25 years ago, perhaps more than that, Ken, some number of years ago, in the 60s. And, of course, ours, the rest of them, gained university status in 1982, November 12th of 1982. Now the difference, though, is a very important question. In our earlier day, the 50s, 40s and 50s, 60s, we were teachers' colleges. That was our primary mission. Now, we had the liberal arts programs to turn out the teacher education majors in physics and chemistry, so we had the foundation for the liberal arts degree. And then in the 60s, we developed the majors in liberal arts and sciences. So we had the degrees in teacher education, the degree in arts and sciences. And then we developed business and nursing. So what really happened to these colleges is they developed several colleges at the site. And often in the public sector across the country, there are about 300 institutions not dissimilar from ours. The SUNY schools, State University of New York institutions, the Cal State schools, and every state has been privileged to have these teachers' colleges that became multipurpose and eventually universities. An institution like Ball State in Indiana, Bowling Green in Ohio. These were teachers' colleges that became multipurpose and grew and added. And normally the university status came when there were several schools. So, for instance, at many of our campuses, there would be a school or a college of education, a college of arts and sciences, a college of business, a college of nursing, and a college of art and music. There could be that at two or three of ours. And I believe at California, there's a college of technology. And so as they developed across the country with these multi-purpose programs, and then developed master's degrees, in some cases IUP, Indiana University, doctoral degrees, we changed to university status at that point. There are institutions that have, it's a little complicated because there are institutions across the country that have several schools and still call themselves colleges, and there's some very small institutions that are pretty have most people in the same program that call themselves universities. But normally, the characteristic of public universities is when you develop several schools at each institution.
What is I think there's a lot of misconceptions again that I heard at the hearings. How do we define a full-time student, and how do we define a part-time student?
That is part of the dilemma that it seems confusing. But normally, our institutions require 128 credits to graduate. And in order to make that in eight semesters, you would have to do 16, 17, perhaps an 18-credit semester, a 15, in order to reach that. And in order to graduate in eight semesters, that would be a full, when I say a credit, 16, 17 credits. Many of our courses are three-credit courses. Sometimes there's a one-credit course. And but that's how we count the degree. And to be a full-time student for FEA, the Pennsylvania Higher Education Program, I believe it requires 12 credits. They are willing to support the student if they take 12 credits. But normally, eight semesters would be viewed as the traditional time that it would take to get the typical baccalaureate degree. Some programs, because of their special accreditation natures, do require some additional courses. The trouble with getting through in the eight semesters is that if a student changes a major, if they flunk a course, if they need a pre-course to be able to get in the advanced course, then that slows up the process. Some students are able to go in the summer and make that up, and others take a fifth and sixth year. We do gain very rapidly on our four-year graduation rate if you include the summer after graduation. If you go to the fifth year, then the numbers go up quite a bit. I should point out that there are students today who want to go to college and take the courses they need, but they don't expect to get a degree. And they shouldn't be looked at as people that didn't somehow reach the final accomplishment. There is nothing wrong with it. It seems to me it's very appropriate for a older student who works in a business and needs courses in accounting or personnel work or psychology to take those courses and have their needs met without that necessarily ending up in a baccalaureate. So we don't see a student who took important courses that they need but didn't graduate as necessarily a waste of public resources or a waste of their time. They got what they needed at the time.
And I think that's very much in alignment with the President of the United States and his goals in lifelong learning. You know, when we look at numbers, again, I keep coming back to this, it's very deceiving if you don't know the background and the demographics involved when you're looking at those numbers, which is why I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about these things, because as an educator, I understand, and as a businesswoman, I understand how often numbers can be misleading to people who don't understand where these numbers come from. Are the entrance requirements for each of the state schools different, and are they different from private institutions, and or do they vary within the state system itself?
Each one of our universities in this state system of higher education, each one of them are able within broad board policy to decide on their admission requirements. That means that they differ. And they differ sometimes because of the demographics of the region in terms of large numbers of applicants versus other places, and they are different. And we think, rather than a criticism, that's a great strength. There are some systems that have central admissions where everybody applies to a central location and then is assigned a campus. We rejected that idea when our system was formed. I was a president at that time because we thought that one size does not fit all, and we thought it would be better for the citizens of the Commonwealth to be able to visit several of our institutions and decide the one that would be best for them. That's first. Second, we thought that the institutions would be more on their toes and more entrepreneurial if they had to work very hard to get the customer and wouldn't just get them assigned from the central office. So for our reasons at that time, it doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be looked at again. We thought the individual decision-making at each institution within broad system guidelines was the way to go. Now, as a result of that, a student that might be acceptable at one institution could be declined at another. And we're trying to do better now than we did earlier in telling those parents and students that they ought to look at another opportunity within the system. Sometimes a major will fill up at one institution more quickly and will be available somewhere else. We do have the same high-quality faculty across the system. They're all part of the same bargaining unit and have the same requirements generally. So we are diversified in terms of this admissions question. Now, this is just my own view, and it may cause some controversy with your listeners, and people are entitled to have their own view. But I'm a great believer in access. I believe that there are students who perhaps didn't do as well as they had hoped in high school. They were not motivated. They were not mature enough to know the seriousness of it. But they get the message, and at a certain point, they want to be more than they thought they originally had planned to be, and that they need to get to college. And I'm a great believer in giving every student an opportunity, and by that I mean give them an opportunity to try. Every taxpayer student that graduates from high school, in one sense, it seems to me, somewhere in the system, ought to have an opportunity to do their very best to succeed. And it's quite amazing. I've seen it. I've been, as you asked me earlier, I've served as a professor and as a dean, and I've worked with parents and students, and I've seen students that were very immature would drop out, and later, as a result of a work experience or going to a military experience, come back, and they're very motivated, they're very successful, and they move ahead. So I'm a great believer in what I call access and giving everybody a chance. That does not mean that you water down your expectations. And it does not mean that you graduate an accountant at the end that does not know accounting. But it means that it might take longer for some, and you need to give them an opportunity. And that's why that I don't want to be too severe on the 4 years, because I think there are students that with a little extra help, a little extra time, can really get going. And in the end, you can still have very high standards and access.
You have summed up in 1 minute my feelings about the state system schools, and I appreciate that. I completely concur. You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Dr. McCormick from the State System of Higher Education. You can reach his office and call Ken Marshall at 717-720-4054. If you have any questions, it's 717-720-4054. Or you can go on the website at sshechan.edu. That's www.sshechan.edu. Or you can call us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. I have 1,000 questions to ask you. We only have 15 minutes left. So we have moved, the United States government, the Department of Ed, and this current administration has moved from instructional education to learning as a focus at the Department of Education, which means that we have moved, in essence, and I'm really simplifying this, from a testing mentality to a demonstration and real world mentality. How does that equate to students who are coming into, in other words, what I'm saying to our listening audience is that before, your SAT scores, your GPA, your grade point average, your grades in school were the be-all and end-all. How is that changing today in terms of entrance?
Well, I believe that the university system is certainly, as a result of our strategic plan and so on, is becoming much more learner-centered, student-centered, you could call it, or even client-centered. By that I mean the higher education system is becoming much more responsive to the needs of individual students, to the using technology and whatever tools we have to tailoring things more to what students need in terms of their goals and their expectations. And at the same time, rather than just measuring how many hours you sat in class or how many library books or how many PhDs the institutions have. We've moved much more to the measurement of outcomes. And I think we're just in the midst of this, and you're going to hear a lot more. I hope for the day, really, when institutions like ours are measured by the add-on value. In other words, as a result of a student coming to our place and the investment that was made, how did we improve their ability, their knowledge, and their outcomes? And so I think it's really good. I think that's happening in all of society. That's a great change in America now. Even in our evaluation of our administrators now, we're not into automatic raises, but more along the line of what are their goals, did they accomplish them, and they're going to be measured more and more on the outcomes. And I think that's appropriate. I'm being very supportive. And I believe that our students, as they go into the world of work, will find themselves in an environment where it's not necessarily about the process, it's about the results. Did they make the goals? Did they accomplish the objectives? And not just went through the motions and put the time in. And so I see all this as quite positive.
One of the problems in our country, and I think one of the reasons why we have a great deal of confusion about education, is because no one can agree how to define educational success. What does it mean to be an educated person? And I wanted to know what your feeling, your personal opinion is on how you measure college success. We talk about it all the time, or university success. What does that mean in today's 21st century student?
We're spending a lot of time thinking and talking about that, and I would frame my answer in the reality that graduates of today will have to change jobs and careers many times. Some say 6 or 7, but it could be more. And so I think one of the things that we need to develop in our graduates is the ability to cope with change, to be agile, to be able to have the kinds of learning, continuous learning, lifelong learning characteristics that help them change and cope and develop and meet the changing needs of not only their workplace but their lives. Now, in order to do that, I do think there's a certain fundamental competencies that people do need to have today. Writing skills are still important. Listening skills are more important than some realize. Certain basic mathematical skills, and I would add that as we become more global, we have to have some language skills and some cultural understanding of the broader global environment, because we live and work and travel in a more global world. I would add to that that technology, it seems to me, is going to be at the heart of a lot of this change. And so there needs to be a certain level of computer and technological competence that is developed. One of the things that when I have an opportunity to talk to the graduates that I mention is that ability to think creatively, to be able to problem solve, to take an issue and to be able to think it through, to sometimes get out of the box, as we say. And then what one hope that I would have for our students is that they love learning, so that they engage in lifelong learning and realize that when you get the baccalaureate degree, it's not the end. It's a continuing life of growing, learning, and contributing.
Well, I'd like for you in this last few minutes to sum up where you think, what do you think the direction of the state system of higher ed, where do you think we're going for the 21st century, and how do you meet those needs, and where do you think state system should go?
Well, I'm approaching my leadership responsibility with the system through the work of a planning commission that we have assembled. It has 30 people on it, individuals from the business community and so on. And I'm hoping over the next several months that we will be thinking about the university system, what we've done, what we've accomplished, but take a little bit more time to look outward, not necessarily inward, and to talk with business leaders, other leaders of the state, and really look at the demographic changes, the changes in business technology. We had a summit here, a technology summit, where we brought in some of the individuals to talk, and that we would do what I would call an external scan. And then as a result, when we're doing it through our business, we have our new business alliance, corporate alliance, where we're talking to business and talking to other needs, and that we would, as a result of that, take our very fine existing strategic plan and refine that in terms of the changes that need to be made. But I would see some of the changes falling out this way. One is what I would call a better alignment with what we produce, with what the state, what the Commonwealth needs. And we need to, based on facts, do a better alignment. If we have a shortage of teachers for inner city schools, we need to work on that. If we need to do more of computer scientists and software engineers, we need to develop the programs. If we need to do better in rural health, we need to work on that. So there's a better alignment with this product, with what we produce and what is needed, still respecting our old values, still respecting the liberal arts, of course. And so that alignment in terms of programs needs to go on, and there needs to be some very specific plans at each campus as to what changes we're going to make to help align the delivery of services in the university system with what's needed. Now that then will bring into play our investment in technology and how we use technology, not as a threat, but as a tool to help us do the alignment, get things done, and serve in these new ways. And I see technology as a great breakthrough and a great tool to help us get it done. No faculty should be afraid of it. They should see it as an opportunity to teach their classes even more creatively, and we ought to see it as an opportunity to deliver services in new and creative ways. And I'm very committed and very excited to the investment in technology. But I don't want us to become a slave to the technology. I want it to be the slave to the mission and the goals and the direction. And then I see that the investment in capital in the system, that is our buildings and our facilities, will need to mirror the changes that we need to make. So that if we're going to invest public money in renovating buildings and building new ones, they need to be the kinds of buildings that give us the very complex scientific equipment, computer equipment, and so on, that will have our graduates come right out into the world of work and not only be up to speed, but be a leader in changing. We ought to be the center of excellence, and actually our graduates ought to be able to help their employees move to the next step rather than their always having to bring our students up to them. It ought to be the other way around. And that needs to be tied in. And then I would hope that this strategic plan this time would look at marketing and telling our story better. Because whether it's a change in name that would better reflect what we do, better telling the story to the people who own this system, the citizens of Pennsylvania, and I think that communications and that marketing is a term we've not used in higher education, but I think we do have to do a better job of communicating with the Pennsylvanians who own the system. And that's not only students, but it's the people that pay the bill. And I would hope that would emerge. And then perhaps... our most important, we exist for students, but our most important part of the delivery are our personnel. And we're going to have to realize that even though we have these PhDs from great institutions, we have good managers, that we are going to have to invest in them in a continuous improvement and development model, because the way things are changing, we're going to help our personnel grow and change and develop so that they can do the kinds of things that our students need and our universities need. So I see a revision in the strategic plan, basically based upon what we've already are doing, and then all of these other things falling in the line to help move the university system. And in the final analysis, it's high quality, it's affordable, and then finally responsive to the needs of this state.
You have been listening to Children Come First with Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We have been here this exciting morning with Dr. McCormick, who is Chancellor of the State System of Higher Education. If you'd like to find out any information on the state system schools, you can phone Ken Marshall at 717-720-4054. That's 717-720-4054. You can also go to the State Systems website, which is www.sshechan.edu. That's www.sshechan.edu. Or you can reach us here at Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and you can reach us toll-free at 877-PROKIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. You can also reach us by email at ProKids, P-R-O-K-I-D-S, at rlc.net. That's ProKids, P-R-O-K-I-D-S, at rlc.net. And before I leave, I'd like to say one more time, some of the schools that are part of the state system of higher education, they are, and I'm sure I won't have all of them here, Bloomsburg, Cheney, Clarion, East Stroudsburg, Edinburgh, Indiana, Kutztown, Lock Haven, Mansfield, Millersville, Shippensburg, Slippery Rock, Westchester, and California University. So those are the schools that we have been speaking about with regard to the state system of higher education. Those are the state system schools. And if you'd like any information about any of them, or the different as we talked about earlier with the chancellor, that each one of them has requirements that are different, and perhaps if your child was denied access to one of the state system schools, they could perhaps attend a different one. If you'd like any information about that, you can call Ken Marshall at 717-720-4054. That's 717-720-4054, or go to the website at www.sshechan.edu. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and we appreciate your listening to us every week. And of course, this month is our month of talking about higher education and the potentials of higher education for students, with the president's and this administration's thrust for lifelong learning. And it doesn't mean that you have to get a degree, or a two-year degree, a four-year degree. If you'd like to bone up on your skills for your job, you can do that at any of the state schools. Thank you again for joining us. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye.